Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Danielle Lazarova and we begin with the news. An Azerbaijani political refugee who was arrested on a brief visit to his homeland has been allowed to return to the Czech Republic. Professor Sadai Nazarov, who was granted political asylum in the Czech Republic in 1997, returned to his homeland in January to visit his ailing father. He was arrested on treason charges and spent over 3 months in detention. His release was secured after weeks of intense diplomatic negotiations when the Azerbaijani authorities agreed to halt legal proceedings against Nazarov. The 58-year-old dissident arrived at Prague's Ruzyně Airport in relatively good health and was met by family and friends. Support for the new government of Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek remains uncertain, with 5 Social Democratic Party deputies unwilling to accept the new government set-up. The old new government must ask for a vote of confidence in the lower house within 30 days of taking office, and with its slim majority in parliament, the 3-party coalition needs the support of all its deputies. The opposition Civic Democrats and the Communists have said they will not support the new cabinet. The 5 Social Democratic Party deputies, whose vote is uncertain, say they would like to strengthen their party's influence in certain areas of government. Behind the scenes, negotiations continue. The government has rejected the Civic Democratic Party's proposal of a one-off referendum bill on the EU constitution. The 3 governing parties have produced their own referendum bill, which is far broader and would enable a referendum to be held on any vital issues relating to the country's future. Both proposals will be debated in Parliament. The approval of either of those bills would open the door for Czechs to vote on the EU constitution. Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek has said that the ratification of the EU constitution is a top priority. The new cabinet is expected to launch an information campaign on the EU constitution within a matter of weeks. President Václav Klaus has already come out strongly against its ratification, publishing a brochure in which he enumerates all the possible pitfalls. A police officer has received a 2-year suspended sentence for shooting at a pedestrian crossing a street on a red light. The incident happened on a busy Pilsen crossing, where the officer is said to have fired 3 shots at a pedestrian who ignored his calls to stop. One of the bullets hit a passing car. The police never traced the pedestrian in question. The officer said he had fired the shots because he suspected that the man in question was a sought-after criminal. He was found guilty of abuse of power and presenting a public threat, and has been banned from working in the police force for a period of 5 years. I'm Daniela Lazarová, and that's the end of the news.
This is Radio Prague's English service, and I'm Kate Barrett. Coming up, Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek's coalition government faces internal threats. The 7th annual International Documentary Film Festival Jeden Svět opens in Prague. And we bring you memories of the Second World War from a woman's perspective in our Women in War series. That's all coming up, so don't go away. The crisis in the Czech government appeared finally to be over earlier this week when Jiří Paroubek replaced Stanislav Gross as prime minister. But Mr. Paroubek's coalition government, with a majority of just 1 in parliament, is now facing a threat from within his own Social Democrats. Up to 5 of the party's MPs say they won't support the government in a confidence vote unless their man, Hinek Kmoniček, is made second in command at the foreign ministry. They want to curtail the influence of Christian Democrat Foreign Minister Cyril Svoboda, who they say is too pro-American. Ian Willoughby discussed the situation with one of the rebel Social Democrats, Jan Kavan, himself a former foreign minister.
We have never said that the crisis equals opposition of First Deputy Foreign Minister. What's important for us is to ensure that the Czech Social Democratic Party, as the largest government party, will have sufficient influence on both the formation, formulation and implementation of foreign policy. The post of a first deputy is one of several aspects, clearly not the only one.
The new old government has a majority of just 1 in parliament and it has to undergo a vote of confidence in the next few weeks. How will you and your colleagues vote if your demands aren't met?
Obviously, to talk about demands and ultimatums is an exaggeration. We are negotiating, and obviously the whole art of politics is to find a compromise, a consensus, and we are open for that. On the other hand, if there will be no compromise, no consensus, if all our arguments are simply rejected or ignored, and the status quo, whereby the Ministry of Foreign Affairs implements sometimes foreign policy contrary to the government program and to the program of the Social Democratic Party, then I would find it very difficult to vote for such a government.
Czech voters are no doubt tired, or maybe sick and tired, of this crisis. It's gone on for a long time now. Aren't you afraid that some voters may blame you if it drags on for even longer?
Yes, I think that that's a real danger that this will happen. I'm aware of it, but that's a risk I have to take in order to square my political behavior with my conscience.
Stanislav Gross resigned as Prime Minister at the beginning of this week, but he's still the chairman of your party. He's lost a lot of support now. Do you think he can lead the Social Democrats into elections next year, or has he become a liability?
This is on the party leadership to make such a decision before the election campaign starts. If this government will survive till the proper date of the election next June, I assume that a decision who will be the final, who will be the party leader, will be taken sometime during autumn.
Social Democrat Jan Kavan there. We move now to negative views of lobbying held widely in the Czech Republic. The practice of lobbying has long been accepted as an effective, if sometimes controversial, part of the modern political process, with no shortage of lobby groups everywhere trying to influence government policy and legislation. But in formerly communist countries, it's still relatively new, and not without its detractors. Lobbying here is still widely associated with corruption in the public eye. Jan Wellinger has the details.
It's true that lobbying does not enjoy a favorable reputation in the Czech Republic, among the public, and even among many politicians. The PR agency Donat Bersin-Marsteller recently released the results of a survey it conducted in tandem with a professional polling firm, showing how Czech politicians viewed lobbying here and areas where improvements could be made. Less than half of 362 interviewed felt lobbying was useful as an information tool. DBM's Jiří Šebek.
The attitude of elected officials is much more positive, I'd say, than the attitude of the general public. But it's not as positive as it is in the European Union. We found out that a bit less than half of the people that we talk to think about lobbying positively. The rest don't like lobbying. They have a very definite ideas about why lobbying is bad.
One reason why lobbying gets a bad rap is because the country has failed to introduce regulations requiring lobby groups to declare their interests more openly at regional and government levels. Jiří Šebek says lobbying's image would improve if such rules were in place. But he also takes the optimistic view.
The thing is that there have been things positive done on the side of the politicians. There are legal initiatives, bills regarding and regulating conflicts of interest, which are being passed. So things are happening and changing. On the other hand, we miss specific laws on lobbying or regulations. There are none, as far as I can see. There are none.
Ada Krnáčová of the watchdog group Transparency International is far more critical of the Czech political scene.
It's highly corrupt in our society, and lobbying is a part of it. So it's difficult to exclude it and say, okay, lobbying is somehow cleaner than the other part of the political life. So it's part of it. So it's as contaminated as the political life in Czech Republic.
When it comes to lobbying, many, like Ada Krnáčová, are skeptical of Czech politicians' ability to separate the wheat from the chaff, to differentiate between information that is truly useful from pure self-interest of lobby groups.
my experience is that the level of education and the overall, let's say, intelligence level in the political life in Czech Republic is pretty low. People are not used to work with information. They can't properly extract information from gossip. The output is accordingly, because if you see the amount of laws which had to be changed due to their lack of quality, it's immense. Yeah? Politicians are not making the effort. They don't have the ability.
That may seem like unduly harsh criticism, but Ada Krnacheva points, for example, to a Prague Post survey last year revealing how few Czech politicians spoke additional languages, leaving them paralyzed or reliant on secondary sources in comparison and analysis, compared to their EU counterparts. Finally, what of the report by Donat Bersin-Marsteller? It points out interesting differences between the Czech Republic and other countries in the European Union. For instance, Czech politicians seem ready to rely far more on their own research and gut instincts, or that of their closest colleagues, than take expert advice from outside. Whether this is a limitation is open to interpretation, but it does not end there. In Great Britain, for example, politicians give far greater weight to other information sources, such as the media. Here the media is rated among the least important. In the end, the study does suggest that the politicians here who do welcome lobbying want greater transparency. There does seem to be a growing awareness that bribes, kickbacks, and shady dealings of all sorts are no longer lobbying at all, but crimes.
Thanks, Jan. Just a reminder that you're listening to Radio Prague. On Wednesday, the seventh year of the Human Rights Documentary Film Festival, One World, began in Prague. It's organized by the Czech humanitarian organization, People in Need, and over 7 days it will feature 120 documentary films from 35 countries. Martin Mikulay's report begins with the festival jingle.
Edition. At the opening ceremony, a special prize was awarded to a film called Peacekeepers by Canadian director Paul Cowan. The film is about the work of United Nations troops trying to prevent an ethnic massacre in Congo. The festival organizers are trying to focus on documentaries that explore, question, and challenge the complexities of the times in which we live. So it is no coincidence that it was organized by a charity organization like People in Need, says the festival founder Igor Blažević.
People in Need is an organization working in a crisis spots, but also, let's say, working here in the Czech Republic in moments of the crisis like floods. And we are also very much involved in a work with Roma communities and socially excluded communities. The festival is one of the really main vehicles for the People in Need to draw attention of the Czech public on current affairs, on, let's say, challenges of the world we are living in.
Every year, One World focuses on different human rights issues or problems. I asked Igor Blažević which topics are being tackled this time.
There is a number of the topics that the festival is dedicated to. I will just mention a few of them, let's say film and a woman. It's not only films about the woman rights, but it's also films made by women filmmakers. We have approached a couple of very prominent women filmmakers like Kim Longinotto from the UK, Miss Portillo from the Mexico, the Barbara Kople from the United States, and Pirjo Honkasalo from the Finland, really the great filmmaking names, and we have asked them to help us select the favorite woman films in their life.
But film and women is not the only focus this year.
Another important topics are Shadows of Africa, about the, let's say, deep impact that European colonialism had on the African continent, the extremely relevant, important section on North Korea, which is not so much focused on security issues, but is very much focused on the plight of the North Korean refugees. There is a section on Bosnia. There is a section, let's say, on a right to tradition, about the impact of the modern world on a different native community all around the world, and altogether 15 different thematic sections, Iraq in a hotspot, bringing really a completely different perspective on current situation in Iraq from what we see on the news. In these films there is no clear-cut answers, but it's really bringing us a little bit more understanding how situation complicated is.
Apart from films, the festival also offers other events, such as debates with filmmakers and a number of photography exhibitions. After May the 5th, when the festival concludes in Prague, it will move to a number of other towns around the Czech Republic.
Thanks, Martin. And you can hear more about the festival, the films it's featuring, and meet some of the festival guests in the arts next Friday. You're listening to Radio Prague, where we now turn to our weekly Women in War series to commemorate the anniversary of the end of the Second World War. The retired teacher Ludmila Sedlova was a teenager during the Second World War. In her choice of profession, she was inspired by her father, who was headmaster at the so-called Teachers' Institute in Panska Street, just off Prague's famous Na Přikopé Street. Ludmila Sedlova lived with her family right in the school, originally built by the Piarist order in the 18th century.
To jsem se ještě jmenovala Šornerová a tatínek byl ředitel.
My surname was Šornerová then, and my father was school headmaster at the Teachers' Institute in Prague, where we lived too. One night my dad was snoring really badly, so my mum made another bed for him in another room. And precisely that night, when we were all sleeping, the Gestapo came to our house, looking for some fugitive. They rang the bell around 1 o'clock, came in, and saw we had an extra bed in our flat. And immediately they started suspecting that we were hiding someone. But luckily, my mother spoke German, so she explained to them the situation with my father being a noisy sleeper. So it all turned out well for us. We never found out whether they really caught the man they were looking for. But the rumor was that someone really had been sleeping in the attic of the ancient building of the former Piarist College.
Říkalo se, že tam někdo spal na půdě. To je strašně stará budova, to tam je bývalých piaristů.
That was Ludmila Sedlova there speaking about one of her memories of the Second World War. Well, it's now time for Panorama with Brian Kennedy.
So infamous a womanizer was the Italian-born libertine Giacomo Casanova that, a full 2 centuries after his death, his name remains synonymous with the art of seduction. But if not for the years he spent as a librarian in the employ of Count Waldstein of Bohemia, Casanova, the world's greatest lover, a one-time consort of European royalty, popes and cardinals, and a man known to the likes of Voltaire, Goethe and Mozart, may have been consigned to obscurity. As it was, he barely found the peace to write his memoirs.
Casanova is buried 14 steps in front of the church of St. Barbara, a little bit in the right direction.
To the right. One step for each year he spent here. Is that the symbolism?
Maybe something from Kabbalah. He knew some parts of Kabbalah, the Jewish black magic.
Like Madonna.
Yeah.
A singer. She's a student of it.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Yeah. But Casanova was better.
Jakub Mrazek is my guide through the Chateau Duchsov, where the world's greatest lover spent the last fifth of his life. During his 73 years on this earth, Giacomo Casanova studied for the priesthood, became a Freemason, an alchemist, a doctor of law, and, most probably, a spy for the very same Venetian inquisitors who exiled him from the tiny nation-state of his birth. And, as my guide Jakob has alluded to, Casanova was well-versed in the Kabbalah, the mystic interpretation of Jewish law. The legendary Italian libertine dabbled in the occult and was believed by many of his contemporaries, to say nothing of his countless lovers, to possess magical powers. Is there some mystery around the grave itself?
No, but about grave there's some story. The Count of Waldstein made a cross on grave of Casanova's very big cross, and because after death of Count of Waldstein, nobody knew who Casanova was, the grave was very destroyed after 100, 200 years. And when the women goes to the mass, to the church on Sunday, they could destroy their clothes because of this very big cross. And they say that Casanova doesn't leave the women after his death.
Even after his death, yeah. He won't leave women in peace. Mm-hmm. But that cross has been removed now.
Yes. There's no graves and no churchyard.
So we couldn't see his grave now?
No.
Whether or not Casanova had magical powers, we shall never know. But one thing is for certain. Casanova, who took some 116 lovers in his lifetime, by his own reckoning, died at Chateau d'Uxov, impotent, both literally, in terms of the loss of his sexual prowess, and figuratively, for his inability to improve his station in life.
In this corridor, you can see a lot of pictures of towns and cities around all Europe and Asia. And all these cities has Casanova visited. For example, Madrid, St. Petersburg, Moscow, Istanbul, Paris, of course, London, Venezia, and so on.
I read that he traveled something like 60,000 kilometers over his life.
Yes, it can be, yeah.
For a man who was feted as an adventurer and spent a lifetime traveling, much of it on the run from church and state authorities and jealous men, Casanova had a rather short commute to work in his final employ as librarian to the great collection of Count Josef Karl Emanuel von Waldstein.
He had to go across the yard through this gate and upstairs to the tower.
In the year 1785, the Waldstein family library already exceeded some 40,000 titles. But Casanova, as librarian, did little, if anything, to collate or catalogue these dusty volumes. He read a great deal, to be sure, but spent the majority of his time in Bohemia writing letters and philosophizing.
I had women, I played, I joined in the fun of not hiding myself.
Count Waldstein shared Casanova's love for gambling and magic tricks, but was all too often absent. Isolated for months on end at the chateau, Casanova retreated to the world inside his head.
What pleasure in recording pleasures, but what punishment to my mind.
While in Bohemia, in hopes of winning fame as a writer and gaining back his fortune, Casanova wrote what is considered to be the first ever science fiction novel. He also translated Homer's Iliad and Odyssey into Italian and wrote a mathematical treatise on squaring the cube.
Casanova's job was to do some system in this huge library, but he did just nothing. He only wrote his books and his correspondence.
Indeed, Casanova's chief occupation was the writing of his memoirs. He spent, on average, 13 hours a day writing what was to become the 12-volume Histoire de ma vie, the history of my life.
I'm writing my life in order to laugh at myself. I write 13 hours a day.
Writing would ensure Casanova, in death, the fame that had proved fleeting late in his life. In celebrating his past, Casanova made up for the drudgery of his daily life in Bohemia. Not a day went by when Waldstein's servants didn't torment him with minor indignities.
The helper of Count Waldstein broke Casanova's portrait and used it as a toilet paper. He was very unhappy here, of course.
A witty conversationalist, Casanova had found himself the odd man out in German-speaking Bohemia.
He spoke five languages. Italian, of course, Latin, Greek, French, and English.
No German?
No German. That's the reason he was very unlucky here. All people around him here in Dutzow spoke German, so he wasn't very popular.
the man who once dreamed of becoming a priest, Casanova came to delight in seducing the wives and daughters of his benefactors.
Happy are those without harming anyone, pursue pleasure.
While in Bohemia, he is visited by the German poet Goethe. He helps Mozart's librettist finish his opera Don Giovanni ahead of its premiere in Prague. These happy events were few and far between. Casanova died on the 4th of June, 1798. Casanova's spirit, or at least Jakub Mrazek tells me, is not at rest.
We have one spirit, if you want to see him.
Casanova's spirit lives here.
Yeah, of course. He has to write his memoirs because in Histoire de ma vie he wrote only about 49 years of his life. So it means unfinished work.
Unfinished work.
He, a restless soul. He must finish it.
Where does he do his work?
So?
Presumably. That's a surprise. I wasn't expecting that. We now see the man himself. He's got a great Roman nose. Must say, and he's working here in a hidden room. So, tell me, this is his secret writing chamber.
No, it's just only for visitors, our chateau. It's not origin.
So he didn't have a secret chamber?
No.
Well, we're almost out of time here at Radio Prague. For now, from me, Kate Barrett, and all of us here, thanks so much for joining us, and goodbye.
Poslouchá.